Well, hello and a very good evening to you. It's as if I've never been away. Welcome along to this year's third episode of On the Front Foot, our Suzy Radio cricket chat show. For various reasons, many of them personal, we're a week early for the show that should have been at the beginning of August, but not to worry, there's lots and lots for us to talk about tonight. And we've got three splendid guests joining Tim Bowling and me. We don't have a telephonist or receptionist with us tonight, so if you'd like to get in touch with the show in the next couple of hours, you can text us 07480 025 010. You can email studio@suzyradio.com, S-U-S-Y radio, all one word. We'll keep an eye on both those feeds. And if you're social media minded, you can tweet us at Suzy Radio. And again, that's S-U-S-Y-R-A-D-I-O. Our guests this evening are John Colcutt from Newdigate Cricket Club, Jonathan Dean, who manages Merstham Under 8s, and finally, all the way from Sussex, Tom Trowbridge is joining us later on. He's the skipper at Burgess Hill in Division 3 of the Sussex Cricket League. But before we do anything else tonight, we have this from Paul Howard, who's the chairman of Outwood Cricket Club. Phil Alexander, club captain of Outwood, collapsed on the evening of Monday the 17th of July after a game of tennis with a fellow club member, and despite the immediate attention of paramedics and the air ambulance, later died at the Royal Sussex County Hospital in Brighton. Phil's passion for cricket was boundless. He was a stalwart at Outwood, but would leap at the chance of a game for any side, short of a player. He played for numerous local sides. He was captain of Outwood's seconds in 2011 and 12, captain of the Sunday first 11 in 2016, and this season was elected first 11 captain. He'd made his Outwood debut in a league second 11 match on the 24th of July 2004, and his first 11 debut followed on the 14th of August that year. Phil was an all-rounder. His highest score was 101 against Lesser Wanderers in 2014, best bowling 6 for 26 against Horsmonden that same year, and he even had three stumpings to his name. Phil ran his own tree surgery business, but he had two passions in life, cricket and fishing. He'd only just returned from what had become an annual fishing holiday in France with friends, and that holiday was the only reason he'd miss a game of cricket. Phil was a hugely popular figure, and he'll be sorely missed by his family, his partner Wendy, his teammates and his many friends. And on the front foot, send their sincere condolences to Wendy, to Phil's family and to everybody at Outwood. Tim, good evening.
Good evening, David. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. John Colcutt from Newdigate Cricket Club. Good to see you back at Suzy 103.4.
Hello, David. Been a long innings tonight?
Well, I've been on 2 hours this afternoon, so plenty to do, but not to worry. John, it strikes me that when a club loses not just somebody who's venerable and full of years and deserves a bench on the boundary, but when it's somebody who's hale and hearty and full of vigour, it's a very sad event indeed.
It actually tears a cricket club apart. In 2004, we lost our team captain, Russell Haig. He was killed in a car smash, and he was only 24. He was first team captain. And we still talk about him, and his family have given us a bursary. And so every year, eight young cricketers go to the Surrey Cricket School in the evening, and the family pay for that, and they've done it now since 2004. So it's his memory lives on.
That's excellent. Tim, any big memorial things at Leatherhead?
No, not in the same sort of sense. I mean, I think you're right. When John, you're right as well. When you lose somebody who's so vital to any sports club, cricket, football, whatever it is, it makes such a massive difference. It's so hard to get people to sort of undertake all the jobs at the best of times these days. So when somebody who is vital to that club is lost, it's not only is it an emotional upheaval, it's also difficult to replace them just to try and get the jobs done. So very sad at to lose such a great man.
As I say, it's also one thing when you've got, you know, I think of the ground of Hartswood, the grammar school sports ground with the benches dotted around in loving memory of all sorts of people who served for a long, long time. But this really is very, very different and very sad. And it does strike me that, Tim, it's only 3 weeks since Matt Norman was sitting here full of beans and first team vice captain at the age of 21. And what a burden he's got on his shoulders for the rest of the season.
I mean, obviously, as you say, we had him in on the show last time. And I think he's somebody who I think will be able to sort of be able to rise to the challenge. He seemed, full of energy and enthusiasm for the club. So hopefully the club can move forward.
John, how are things at Newdigate?
Yes, pretty good. Like many clubs, availabilities is the biggest problem. But the first team are flying at the moment, playing attractive cricket. Second in the league. They have their cup semi-final against Godalming on the 6th of August in the afternoon. And we're hoping to make quite a big village event out of that. But should be a good match.
Is this something unique in Newdigate's history to get that far in the League Cup?
Well, we've only been in the Fullers League about 4 years now. So we're up against, we started in the second division, we're in the first division now. So we've played one Premier Division side already, so we've got another one to play. No, we're quite happy, but I think it is, yes. I think it's unique.
How's the new pavilion coming along? Because it's a while since we saw the bare bones.
Yes, it looks like a cricket pavilion now. It's got all our memorabilia in, and people tend to be staying later now, which is really, really good. And we have table football, and we get the table tennis table out, and generally make people want to stay a little bit longer. But no, the building is superb.
I think that I've said to you before, John, and I mean, we've done the Remembrance Sunday preparation together and any number of things to do with the village, but of all the villages around, Newdigate has got a very strong village identity.
Yes, it has. We're very, very aware of our history, and it's not just the cricket club. It's throughout. The church is very, very strong, and the church has just I've been re-floodlit again with beautiful floodlighting, and the war memorial is, they were given a legacy. And that's the real centre of the village, so anyone coming in at night time, it really does look beautiful.
How are you? I was just going to interrupt, sorry, David. I was going to say, how are you finding, John, with the Colts? I know we were talking earlier on about sort of availability. How is that happening at Newdigate at the moment?
Well, as far as Colts are concerned, no problem at all. We have around about 70, 80 boys and about 25 girls. So the girls have a special training night on a Thursday, and the boys and some girls, it's mixed at sort of the younger age groups and a bit older actually. They come on a Friday night. So plenty there. The big, big challenge is to try and keep them once they get to the age of 14. And there are quite a lot of things that are different now. Many, many more young people are going to university. They go to university and cricket begins to drift away. And when they come back, there's already a settled side. So do you kick people out who've been playing the early part of the season?
Yeah.
So that is a bit of a difficulty. There is now very much a situation with the younger ones who are doing GCSEs and A-levels that they absolutely do not play cricket during the build-up to the exams. So it isn't a case of, oh, well, get out for an evening. It's absolutely no cricket.
I've never understood that, really, because when I was growing up, it was a sort of real respite from having to do study to go out and play a game of cricket in the evening, whereas just to be locked away doing study. I mean, I know that all the kids have got to study and they've got to do their revision, but to not be able to get out and have a break, I think is, to me, it just seems the wrong way round.
I'd rather get the impression that there is more, I think there's more pressure now on younger people. The demand of getting good grades and getting to the university place, I think, is higher. And of course, when they do go, and some play cricket at university, which is great, but when they do come back, it's difficult to slot them in. And of course, how do you fulfil your fixtures? I mean, we don't have a third team now. And if we had a third team, then it would be a bit easier, but we couldn't fulfil our fixtures. No, I think you've had the same trouble at Leatherhead.
Well, that's it. At Leatherhead, we struggled this season. Unfortunately, the third 11 had to fold because, again, we couldn't get the players out. You know, come the summer holidays, it would have been a lot easier when some of those guys coming back from university are back. But at the beginning of the season, first two games of the season, We couldn't get a team out, and obviously, if you default on three games, it affects other sides from the club in the league. So the decision was taken to withdraw the third 11 from the league. But it's a massive thing to lose a third 11, from a club like that, any club, because it's a perfect way of getting the youngsters through and giving them an opportunity to play in adult cricket.
Well, that's the pathway, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the third 11 is very, very important. But certainly, I think we've suffered for not having a third 11, but we just wouldn't have been able to get a side out.
Exactly. Mm.
Just to backtrack on something you were both saying, and thinking back to my own professional experience, there's no doubt at all in my mind that the pressures, John, as you just said, have increased astronomically on young people to obtain grades, and I fear that there is parental pressure on teachers as far as that's concerned too. And so cricket at school level is really between a rock and a hard place, because a lot of the state schools, for time or money or whatever, or facilities, don't play cricket, which obviously is where the clubs come in with the great upsurge in Colts cricket that there's been. But increasingly, the schools that are able to offer a good standard of cricket and good coaching and facilities find themselves squeezed between examinations and that very short summer term where, I mean, you remember, John, in Richard's time with me at Reigate, I mean, everybody looked forward to the cricket week and then to going off on tour together. But now, the minute the last exam has had the ink blotted dry on it, they're all off on group holidays to the Mediterranean, and so it's just changed out of all recognition.
Well it has, and also, of course, holidays play a big factor, and also the need for young people to work and to earn money to offset their fees, and so they work on a Saturday. Do they want to spend all day Sunday playing cricket, not seeing their mates? I think the answer to that is no, they don't. So I think the idea of juggling around with the format, I don't think it's much that. I think there are other things. 2020 is great. You can say, well, it's really, really quick, but 2020 doesn't suit all the players. If you've got, say, 30 players, it might suit 10, but it wouldn't suit the other 20. But saying that, we have our midweek side, which, David, I know you're familiar with. It's been going now for over 30 years. Now, that is absolutely booming. And this is ex-cricketers, but people who haven't really played cricket but like to. There's a nice barbecue, very friendly atmosphere, and our midweek side is absolutely booming with plenty of players. No shortages there.
John, can I just backtrack on what's actually happening at Newdigate? You've given us the bare bones of Sunday, the 6th of August, but it's a significant day for the club.
Yes, it is. We've reached the Cup semi-final, and we're playing Godalming, who are in the Premiership side. We used to play Godalming many, many years ago, but we haven't for a long time, so it'll be an interesting game, and we want to make it quite a village affair with we're inviting all and sundry to come along, so we hope to get quite a good crowd there. So that should be really, really good.
So it'll be a big day, and plenty of sociable things going on as well.
What, you mean the bar?
Well, far be it from me, you understand. John, let's talk about the league, because you're second at the moment in your division. What happens if you stay second? Does that guarantee you some kind of promotion?
Yes, we get into the Premier Division then, which we'd look forward to.
Have you been in the Premier League before?
No, because we went from the Surrey Downs League into the second division of the Fullers League, and then we got promoted 2 years ago, and now we've had this is our second season in the first division, and it's going well.
And John, tell us a bit about your overseas player who seems to be tearing up a few Surrey Oaks on the cricket pitch, and I understand you've also acquired another very valuable import
recently.
Well,
yes, actually, we've been quite lucky. It's sort of what every club dreams of. A chap called Dave Arnold, he had moved into the area and came wandering up to the club and said, I'm looking for a cricket club. And we took one look at him in the nets and said, right, you're in the first team. He's a very, very good wicketkeeper and a good batsman. Cody Irvine is a tremendous character. He comes from Geelong Cricket Club, and he's been over with us. He's actually staying with me and Tina at the moment, and he's great fun to have, and Tina gives him a hard time. You know, where's your washing? Get your whites in here.
How do you go about getting the overseas players? I mean, is there a sort of agency you go through, or is it just something that people contact the club from overseas with the hope of getting in for a season?
Yes, there is a procedure, and every player has to be vetted by the ECB, and there is a procedure through an agency. And but Cody came on the back of a friend, Dragit Prairie, and so he came, and we're already hoping that he'll come back next year, because you know, he's been a good steady player. But his character and his enthusiasm has rubbed off on everybody.
Does he help out with coaching Colts and things like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's excellent inspirational coach, and he's really, really good. So he's coaching every Thursday with the girls, and on Friday with the big group.
How's your girls' team coming along?
Okay. Availability has been a problem with the under-14s. The under-11s represented Moore Valley at the Surrey Youth Games, and didn't quite qualify, but it was very, very close. They're a lovely group of girls. They're learning very quickly. We've got a festival in Cranley coming up on the 20th of August. We're hosting Prosecco cricket, which
sounds good.
I don't know if you've heard about this, but this is the Surrey Cricket Foundation have been supporting it, and they're going to be providing the cases of Prosecco. And we're hoping to get six ladies teams, mostly mums, coming along. We're going to make three pitches, and the bar will be open all day, and we'll have the barbecue on the go. And in the morning, we'll have a festival for under 11 girls. So that will be a day. That's on the August Bank Holiday Monday.
That sounds as if we might be able to do something. I dare say our main thrust will be at the Godstone Fate and Donkey Derby, but you never know. We might Tim and I might fancy a day out, John. We'll see what we
can. You're into the Prosecco, are you? I can't believe that. You're a real ale man, David.
I can have my arm twisted into a drop of genuine English fizz. Prosecco, I'll leave on the side. Thank you very much. Let's not get into a discussion of the relative merits of English and French sparkling wine. John, before we take a little break for some summer music and then move on, because clearly just been talking about girls cricket, and there's this wonderful Women's World Cup for us to chat about after we take a little break. Anything else at Newdigate at the moment that we really need to hear about?
Well, our girls were guard of honour at the Oval on the Surrey Somerset 2020. That was a week or so ago. Then we had about 60 young players went up to watch. They all had a splendid time, and quite a few of our girls were at the final at Lords, and needless to say, they had an absolutely brilliant time, because that really was tense, and that was fantastic cricket. But I guess the lots of things going on. We have our presentation at the end of September, and we have a Colts versus coaches match. We have a girls versus mums match in the morning, and followed on, and then we do the presentation. So that's always a good way of finishing the season off.
I think vibrant is probably the accurate word for Newdigate Cricket
Club. Well, yes,
but
we do. There is this underlying problem. You look at the Surrey Downs League, and there's 50% of the clubs in that league now only have one team. And it's 50%, and there are going to be teams that are going to fold, and there are going to be teams that are going to struggle even to get one side out. So it's not a good scene at that really grassroots level.
I won't ask you to name any names or offer any pack drill, John, but have you got your eye on possible amalgamations if it should go down that route?
Nope.
Good. Well, I'm pleased to hear that. We're forecast some more rain tomorrow, and John, presumably you were washed out at the weekend.
Well, we gave it a try. We got up to the ground quite early. We got all the puddles off and took the covers off, and we thought the pitch looks good, and we started on time. Bowled 13 overs, and down it came.
Yep.
And it hammered it down, and that was it.
So, all things considered, it was a washout weekend. I've got a couple of Hawley Colts results for the second hour, but that's all. What a mercy that the rain stayed away from Lords on Sunday afternoon. And, gentlemen, what an extraordinary occasion.
Well, it was amazing. I mean, to think how far women's cricket has come, that this is now sort of front-page news, with us winning the World Cup for the fourth time. And it's not as though we've never won the World Cup before. I think a lot of people sort of would read it as being it's the first time we've won the Women's World Cup. We've won it three times before. But what an amazing match. I mean, absolutely stunning finish, really, wasn't it?
And what is this going to do for ladies and girls cricket?
Well, hopefully. It must promote it now, surely.
Must do.
I suppose the one question I ask myself in that context is, what precisely is the lasting legacy of London 2012?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I really take not a lot of interest in athletics, so you'd probably need to ask somebody who was in an athletics club, wouldn't you, at the Priory AC or something. But I just wonder, you know, with the great god football taking over the Olympic Stadium for most of the time and so on and so forth. John, I suppose that Women's World Cup final, I was in here for a while, but I watched the whole of the second innings, at least the bits when I wasn't falling asleep. And, I mean, if ever there were an example that it's never over till it's over. I mean, there was a side that had got the game in their collective pocket. Couldn't lose. 40 needed with 7 wickets standing off however many balls it was, 40 or 39 balls, and yet they contrived to lose it.
David, you've played cricket. You've been in that situation. Home and dry, very confident. One wicket begets another wicket.
Yep.
Panic sets in. Something weird happens. Quick run out. Brilliant bit of fielding. Brilliant bit of bowling. And then suddenly 15 runs looks like 115 runs.
Do you think when the catch went down for the was it the final wicket when the drop catch went
Jenny
down?
Gunn.
Yeah, and do you think she must have thought, that's it, we've blown it?
This is a bit like Shane Warne dropping in the 2005 and losing the Ashes.
Yeah. Well, and Herschel Gibbs in that famous World Cup tie between South Africa when Warne actually turned round and said, you've just dropped the World Cup. I suspect that England thought that even though that was the most unfortunate time to drop a sitter, that they'd probably got a little bit in hand by then.
Yes, I mean, you know, for it to turn round as it did, I mean, you say Shrubsole took 5 for 11 in 19 deliveries.
But just before that, she'd gone for 9 runs in the over.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
an incredible turnaround.
So, did the captain was the captain going to take her off?
Well,
got to change history.
Unbelievable, though, as you say, to get that far. I don't think there was anybody that thought at that point that England would win from there.
No,
I think
you
know, as I say, India were home and host, and they blew it, which is unusual for. I know it's women's sport, but when you see the Indians, their sort of sporting sort of mentality at cricket, they rarely have they ever choked in tournaments. The men haven't. I mean, we haven't seen much of the women's game there, but you know, it's just incredible, really, that it even happened.
Yeah, well, let's put credit where credit's due to the perseverance and the excellence of the England side, that they never, ever gave up. I think the spirit in that side must be fantastic.
I think two things interest me about it. The first is that the media have treated everybody playing throughout as cricketers. There's not been a moment's sense of any kind of chauvinism. There's been no celebrity interviewing. There's been no girly chat about boyfriends or anything like that. They've been cricketers, pure and simple, and I think that's absolutely tremendous. And for a lot of people who must have been enjoying their first big occasion at Lord's, what a tempter to bring them back through the gates.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the whole atmosphere there. I think the kids were all given free commemorative plastic bats to take home and all things like that. It's just, I think the BBC said 1 million people were visiting the website, looking at following the final on their website during the game, which is incredible, really, for women's cricket.
And you know, there were Catherine Granger and the netball girl whose name I can't recall at the moment being interviewed on TV and saying, "We want a bat. We want a signed quick cricket bat."
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing about it is that if women's cricket now takes off in India in the way that T20 took off in India the moment that people there started taking notice, then there's hardly any limit to where it can go.
Well, no, exactly. And I think when India won the World Cup in 1983, the men's side, they reckon it began a boom in the one-day cricket scene there. Likewise, with their T20 World Cup victory, it sparked them trying to get the Indian Premier League off the ground. So I think it's even more important for cricket that the Indians sort of take women's cricket to their heart and start promoting it.
And with the TV exposure, I suppose the other thing, John, is that suddenly we haven't just got household names in that England women's cricket team, we've got household faces. You know, there's Tammy Beaumont all over breakfast television this morning on the sofa, and suddenly they are not so much celebrities, but they are recognisable faces.
Do you know, it's about 3 or 4 years ago, I sat about 40 kids down and held up a picture of Ian Bell, who at that time was our premier number 3 batsman, and only 2 of the kids knew who it was. So,
well,
hopefully now with the women cricketers, a lot of the girls will will recognise them.
Yeah.
Let's hope so. Now, obviously, we're not touting for a recall for Ian Bell necessarily, but in terms of turnarounds, such as the one in the last few overs at Lord's on Sunday evening, what an amazing turnaround as well, gentlemen, in the South Africa Test Series.
Yes, who would have thought that either? I mean, when we were sitting here previously, we were talking about the first test and about how the South Africans looked like they just had no chance during the series. And then all of a sudden, the thing turns round. Joe Root's honeymoon period's over. He's now being castigated by Vaughan and Hussain. Unbelievable, really.
Well, they've got to give him a little bit more time. I mean, for me, the worrying thing is we're playing against a South African side without their best batter and without their best bowler. Mm. And what would have happened if Steyn and de Villiers were playing? But it's a great turnaround by South Africa. We just really didn't play very well, did we? And I'm going to be there on Thursday at the Oval. Can't wait. And I just hope that we see a nice Alastair Cook 100 and set us up for a nice total.
Do you think that Jennings should still be included in the side to open?
Jennings looked very impressive, didn't he, last winter? Hamid looked very, very impressive. I think there is a real question on balance. And obviously, Joe Root played with him for many, many years. And going back, even playing for young Yorkshire. So they've been teammates. I hope he's not sort of influenced too much by that. And we haven't really replaced Jonathan Trott as number three.
No. The problem is, I think, there's such a big jump, and we spoke about this last time, there's such a huge jump from county cricket to test cricket. And you look at the stats, Gary Balance is scoring runs like he's going out of fashion at county level. Mm. He's got a best average, the highest amount of runs scored, yet can't buy a run during the test series.
I know that Joe Root had a couple of chances on that first day at Lord's, but I saw him make 180 odd with given those couple of chances and the wicket off a no ball. And quite honestly, he just looks as to the manner born. He's a good player.
For me, my favourite cricketer was always David Gower, and he's another David Gower to me. He's just so technically correct and very stylish. Nothing seems to faze him. And I didn't think he should have become England captain. Why burden your best player with all of this problem? And then suddenly one defeat, everyone's on his back. It's going to play on his mind. It's going to affect him. Well, he shouldn't have this.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. And we seem to have fallen into this sort of habit now of England of just picking captains because they're the best player. I think Alastair Cook is a phenomenal batsman. But I never really rated him as a captain. I always thought he remains a phenomenal batsman. But again, you're picking captains, purely on their ability as a batsman or a bowler, generally a batsman, rather than picking captains because you believe they could be a good captain.
But we'll never go back to the days of Mike Brearley, will we?
No.
Where we pick somebody because he's a captain. And being a captain isn't just being a captain on the field. They've then got to handle the media. And Alastair Cook was brilliant at that. Mm. And he never put a foot wrong. And I'd imagine he was a fantastic ambassador when we travelled to India, South Africa, Australia. I would imagine that he represented the country in a really, really good way, as Joe Root will, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think we should put that burden on him.
John, sorry, Tim, go on.
No, all I was going to say is a point you made just now, David, is the fact that Joe Root, it's unusual to find a player who is so comfortable in every single format. And you couldn't really say which format or what he's generally a test player or he's generally a one-day player. He is comfortable in every single format. And I think if he maintains his fitness and doesn't get injured, he's going to break every single batting record going.
And he plays the same as well, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, in 2020, he still hits cover drives.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, and you talk about David Gower, it was the same sort of that same fluid sort of proper strokes.
Well, if anything, I mean, Gower always was a bit infuriating, wasn't he? Because he would be absolutely wonderful, and then he would nick off and go off in a Tiger Moth or something. I think Joe Root doesn't seem... You can't really see any technical ability. When he gets clean bowled, it's generally by a ball that will bowl anyone in the world.
Yeah.
John, we're coming to the end of our time. It flies by when you're having fun. Just a little look ahead and cast a few runes for us, if you will. How do you see the South African series panning out now that people like Vernon Philander seem to be giving England so much trouble?
you feel that the pendulum has swung towards South Africa, but England are a very, very talented side. There's a lot of really good players and match winners there, so you can't write them off. I think it's going to be, it could end up being an absolute great game.
And presumably, so long as we don't take them for granted, we brush West Indies aside late in the season?
I guess so. It is a sad thing when you look at the pictures of when the West Indies used to come here, the excitement and the huge Caribbean crowds at the Oval and Lords was really, really exciting. But they haven't got the personalities. They've got to sort out their technical problems with their governing body because they just lose all their best players.
You know that the new chief executive is an ex-pupil of mine?
I didn't know that.
Johnny Grove is the new chief executive of West Indies Cricket.
So that bodes really well then for West Indies Cricket.
Well, we're hoping we might get him in here, you know.
Oh, brilliant.
Having learned at my left knee and other low joints, so to speak. John, as always, it's an absolute pleasure to have you in.
Great to be here.
Representing Newdigate Cricket Club. Thank you ever so much for coming in. And we hope that this year you won't be prevented by health from coming back for the end of season wrap-up. John Colcutt, thank you very much indeed. Susie Radio. Welcome back to On the Front Foot. John Dean from Merstham, thank you very much for filling in for us at relatively short notice, and welcome to Susie Radio.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm glad to be here.
It's excellent to have you here. Now, you manage the under-8s at Merstham.
I manage the under-8s. I also manage the Merstham Pumas, who are an under-11 side.
So tell us, in a nutshell, or you can expand a bit if you like, about how the whole cult system at Merstham is organised.
Well, from what I can gather, in the last few years, of course, we had a whole relaunch, a rebuild of the ground in 2012. And on the back of that, we've built the cult section up so that certainly at 6, 7s and 8s, that's years 1, 2 and 3, we have 71 children registered with us. And then we have two sides at under 10. We have an under 9 side, of course, two at under 11. And then we go on up through the age groups. And it is thriving.
And what about the overall manpower and number of volunteers required to sustain that?
There's never enough. There's never enough. But, on the other hand, we do have a good number of fathers, and we try and encourage them. We always need more. You always need more at that level.
And is there a big burden on the club in terms of, disclosure and barring service, not CRB any longer? Is there a big financial burden on the club with that?
Yes, yeah, I don't know how much that all costs, but certainly there is a lot of work behind the scenes getting people properly authorised for that. And also health and safety-wise in terms of first aid and such like.
And tell us now how a week in the summer life of Merstham's under-8s manager unfurls.
Well, I have to say that the boys, and it is unfortunately all boys at the under-8s level, but they are very keen, they're very available, so it's a very simple task for a manager. Having said that, I do umpire as well. And manage the side on the match day. So that and the under-11s, it takes up a deal of time, but it's all worth it.
And what does that involve you in logistically, day by day?
Well, it's emails, checking availability. As long as people come back to you always, that's what you want. You want a straight answer. You want some certainty about availability. And then liaising with the other clubs. It's great. It really is. And then you just pray for good weather.
And presumably, in terms of electronic communication, the communication is done via parents?
Yes, yeah, absolutely via parents. And we have various group contact arrangements so that we can get the messages out to them.
And a good level of parental support at matches?
Superb, yes, superb. And sometimes you don't always get it. You don't get it at the football. I think people like the cricket. Obviously, the weather's a much kinder thing for them. And also, they get a little bit involved in that they can warm the batting side up before they come out. Of course, every team needs a scorer, and if you're going to have to watch some other parent's child make a hash of things, you might as well do something while you're watching it. So always encourage scorers.
Do you think that is there any plans in the future to try and begin a sort of girls' side around the under-8 level, or is it just not the interest at that age?
I think there is interest. It is about the strength of the girls and the number of the girls. But what we should really be doing, I believe, and I know Richard Feast at Merstham especially is behind this, is integrate these girls into the age group sides. They can play 2 years below if they want to. But I have to say, some of the girls that I have seen playing, especially at under 11 year, level this year, for instance, one of the young girls in the under 11s at South Nutfield, who bowled a hat-trick against us earlier in the season, they really are very good, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be taking part.
Yeah, no, well, it's good. I mean, it's good. I mean, we were talking earlier on about the Women's World Cup and the fact that sort of the female side of the game is growing, and lots of clubs now have a female contingent. I know you said that you don't have the female teams at under 8-11. Mm. There are female teams in Merstham, aren't there?
No, there's not a girls' side. No. We have a disability side.
Oh, okay.
But what we do is, on a Friday evening, the girls do train.
Yep.
We have about 20 girls who come and train on a Friday evening. But they train together as a group, and it's over 3 or 4 years. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. And what we've really got to try and do is understand where those girls are in terms of ability and put them into the right age group so that next year we can really get them going right from nets in February.
I think a lot of it is about integration into just youth sides, male and female. Mm. Look at somebody like Leah Lane at Hawley, who is a leading light. I think she's in their under-13s now. Mm. And she's a leading light just, again, as a cricketer. I think this is one of the great things about it.
Yeah.
Although maybe mixed cricket will never quite come about. Tom Trowbridge is coming later on from Burgess Hill, and Caroline Atkins, who I think played for England, certainly played for Sussex Ladies. I remember seeing Caroline playing at Arundel in a second team game, and relatively military medium seamer put one past her nose, and she was completely at sea. So maybe the mixed thing, apart from charity matches and so on, isn't quite as feasible. John, with under eights, are they playing on what? Well, I'm back in Imperial units. Are they playing on 19 yards with a small ball?
I don't measure these out. You want to talk to the ground. I think it's 18.
18, okay.
Yeah, I think it's 18.
And of course, it's pairs cricket at under 8.
Yeah, absolutely. Pairs, all the batsmen, for those who don't know about pairs, all the batsmen get 4 overs, and everyone bowls for 2 overs, and we are very forgiving. You know, you have to be at that age, encourage them on.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, I think that's the same, certainly. I mean, in my own experience, certainly right up to school first 11 cricket, you know, the bowler's got 6 chances at over and the batter's only got 1, and that's that.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to ruin someone's day by erring just slightly on the side. I mean, youngsters find ways of getting out anyway, don't they?
Yes, yeah. The same.
And how then are... Well, let's focus on your two teams. How are your under-8s and under-11s doing? Is this East Surrey Colts League?
Yes, East Surrey Colts... And I have to blow the trumpet for the under-9s as well, because the under-8s won their league unbeaten. The under-9s have won their league this season. We have the 2 under-10 sides, 1 NEC, 1 East Surrey Colts League. The under-10s, as I understand it, are now second in Division 2 NEC. We have 2 sides out at under-11, and as you appreciate, I'm sure you know, at Merstham, we're non-selective. So at under-11, we have 2 balanced sides, and they've, you know, done pretty well in their league. They're certainly not bottom, they're not top, but a very good performance from both sides. So, yeah, really pleased with the 8s and the 9s. You know, that's 2 league winners, and that's what we're after.
Do you find it difficult during the sort of summer holidays when the kids start going on holiday with their parents? You find it's more difficult to try and get the 2 sides out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. And I think everyone has that problem across Colts. You know, you rely on people playing up. One of the ways we balance it is, especially at, say, under-10s, is we have an NEC side and an East Surrey side, and you can switch players between the two. And a number of clubs do that where they are on the borderline of running 2 teams. So that helps.
The Colts League's pretty much come to an end with the school term, don't they, in any
Absolutely.
Case, John?
Yeah, they're all over now. I think possibly the cup finals were last weekend. I'm not quite sure on those, having not got to any of them.
And is there an ongoing provision for the youngsters to be involved at the club and to train during July and August?
Not organised through the club. There are, Richard Feast runs cricket days up there for them. But it is a private venture.
And I'd imagine, you know, knowing Quality Street reasonably well for many, many years past, I would imagine it's quite a... Do all the junior sides train together? Have you got a mass of kiddies all over the place on one specific evening?
Absolutely. Friday evenings, Merstham's Hidden Secret. Well, with a wonderful... And it is wonderful. There aren't many better places in the area to watch cricket, and you can come down there on a Friday night. The bar opens at 5. What a way to spend Friday evening. Come off the train, come down, watch your child and 71 others at 6, 7 and 8 while you have a quiet drink on the patio looking out across Reigate Hills Golf Club. You can't beat the sight on a summer.
The social side at Merstham then continues to be as good as Nav used to tell us it was, is that right?
I understand it, yes. I'm too busy managing. But yeah, absolutely, they do a great job and we have some really nice evenings down there. It's wonderful, wonderful. Yeah.
And you've got profit margins to consider if the bar's open. I mean, must bring some club funds in.
Absolutely, and yeah, very, very popular. When the sun is out and the barbecue's on, and the colts are all training in front of you, yes, that bar is busy. And
the parents are enthusiastic, then, are they?
Yeah, well, they have to do something, of course, while they're watching. You understand that.
I think that we've been lucky as well, the youngsters have been lucky this year, in that there's hardly been a wet day during the Colts season.
Yeah, we've lost a couple actually on the bank holidays, and a couple of matches went by the bye. I had one go last night, and I actually had one go on Saturday morning. Saturday morning. Sorry, I get mixed up with the two sides on different days. But yes, we've lost some fixtures, I'm afraid, and it's been unfortunate, but not the training nights. No, we haven't lost those.
That's 1 hour of two from On the Front Foot this Tuesday evening on Susie 103.4 completed. Many thanks again to John Colcutt from Newdigate. Always great to hear what's going on down there. I think they're a vibrant club, even if they're struggling a little bit for numbers. And we're halfway through our session now with John Dean, who manages Merstham under 8s and under 11s. And after the news and weather together and another bit of music, we've just got two Colts results, no more than that this week, because it was a washout weekend. And then we'll be talking to John about some of his views regarding the wider elements of cricket. You're with Susie, 103.4. Thanks for the weather, Tim. Here we are back with our second hour of On the Front Foot this Tuesday evening from Susie 103.4. Unusually, very few results. It was a washout weekend, so a couple of results from Hawley Colts. That's all after our next piece of music. If you'd like to get involved in the show, we're here till 9 o'clock. No telephonist or receptionist with us tonight, but you can text us. You can text us on 07480 025010. You can email studio at susieradio.com, S-U-S-Y radio, all one word. You can tweet us at Susie Radio. We'll keep an eye on the Twitter feed. We're back with John Dean from Merstham Colts shortly, and our final guest this evening is Tom Trowbridge, skipper of Burgess Hill in Sussex, who's made the long trek up the M23 to be with us shortly. And after this year's first washout weekend, we have just two Colts results to bring you, both from Hawley. In the East Surrey Colts League, Capel under-12s recovered from 46 for 5 to 108 all-out in 19.3 overs, and Hawley under-12s then fell 7 short at 102 for 6 in their 20 overs. As did the Hawley under-14s, Oxted and Limpsfield making 130 for 5 in 20 overs, and Hawley finishing 5 short of victory on 126 for 5 after 20 overs. John, you've rather self-deprecatingly referred to yourself as a layman. We mentioned the old Sky Sports slogan there just now. I think I'm allowed to say that. Tell us, as a consumer, how you feel about cricket in the media at the moment.
Well, I suppose I look at it through my son's eyes. I have two sons, an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, as you can appreciate. And I suppose it's access to cricket on the media. That's the problem. In my day, when I was their age, you'd spend all day watching test matches, albeit in black and white. And nowadays, you struggle to even find an hour of a highlights show. So that's where I think we're missing out.
It's very easy to assume that lots and lots of people are fortunate enough to be able to afford Sky and BT Sport. Mm. I mean, Sky mainly still for cricket, and there is some move to return a limited amount to terrestrial TV. The BBC are players in the game once again. How do your two sons respond to what they can see?
Fleetingly, I think is the word. There are so many distractions. I listened to one of your interviewees earlier in the evening, and it is very much there are so many distractions, whether it be academic or other sports that they're playing, or their iPads or Xbox or whatever it be. And when I was young, you learnt from watching your heroes on the television. Nowadays, it's very hard for the boys to concentrate long enough to understand what a spin bowler does, to understand what a seamer does, and to understand classic batting strokes.
Have you taken them at all to any of the T20 games?
We, Merston were flag bearers for the first ICC match against Bangladesh, which was great, and both my boys went out, and we were up at the Oval for that, and it was a great day. But, you know, the eldest one wanted to come home at 3:30. Mm. Mm. And it's about keeping their concentration. Yeah. They love playing. They just don't really like watching.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, T20 is meant to be the perfect routine for young kids.
Yeah.
To get them into cricket, watching T20, and then hopefully they go on to watch other levels. But as you say, these days, the attention span is so narrow compared to what it was even when I was a kid. Yeah. That it's very difficult to try and keep their attention, which is why you get at these T20 games all the fireworks going off and everything else going on in the ground and the music going, just to try and keep their attention. But not always easy to do.
It's not always easy, and it still finishes quite late, and on a school night, that's not a possibility. And of course, as an adult, you're always trying to plan ahead as much as you can, but there are unforeseen dates and parties and such like that your children have to go to. And you can't book tickets that far ahead for T20s. I'm too busy managing Colts sides to understand when the next international or next Surrey T20 blast game is coming up.
And of course, the fact remains that even the short form T20 is more than twice as long as a game of good old Knock It Square. But fear not, folks, the glorious 12th of August is nearly upon us, when we'll have another 10 months of pig's bladders and three white sticks. But at least the England women are succeeding in football as well as cricket, so that I think is good to see. Tim, anybody in the, talking about the media, anybody in the current crop of commentators and summarisers and presenters who stands out for you?
Well, I have to say, when Phil Tufnell first started commentating on Test Match Special, and I heard it announced a few years ago that they were going to have Tuffers on there, I just thought, he's not going to be right for Test Match Special. But I think he's absolutely nailed it when it comes to Test Match Special. And I love listening to him, and especially when he's with Henry Blofeld, who I know is retiring at the end of this year. But those two together, I think, are absolutely superb. And they both play off each other so well. Tufnell gets it. He gets Test Match Special. And it makes such a difference having this stream of ex-players coming into the media now who really just sort of regurgitate the same lines. And you get from Tufnell something different. The other person who I think has been quite good, to be fair, and I didn't think he'd be very good, was Flintoff. They had Flintoff commentating, and comes at it from a completely different angle, and just offering something maybe that the kids would like a bit more, but, you know, just something slightly different.
As a gentleman of leisure, I see probably more of Sky Sports than perhaps I ought to. I think Flintoff has been a revelation these last couple of weeks. I think the whole business of eminent cricketers and ex-cricketers doing masterclasses on Sky is phenomenal. Yeah. I really think there's the opportunity there for youngsters to listen and learn. And perhaps surprising that Flintoff was as good as he was at that. He did that session on the square at Canterbury with Rob Key, and I just sat transfixed by that. The other thing that really strikes me is the camaraderie in the Sky Sports pod on television at T20. And I don't know whether either of you saw any of the game at the Oval on Friday night, which was a sellout, clearly Middlesex, and not a great game of cricket. But Shane Warne's commentary at the first six or seven overs was just almost beyond the pale, but beyond good. It was superb. Yeah. It was real, genuine, affectionate banter. Nothing nasty.
I think where Flintoff's concerned is he's one of these people that is just good at everything he does. He does a sports quiz show on Sky One, and there's various sports challenges that are put to him where the other contestants really can't do it. Whatever he's asked to do, he does well. And I think he's just one of those people that's naturally gifted at sport, at communication, and he comes across very, very well and manages to get the enthusiasm of cricket across, which is what we need now.
John, we've monopolised those last couple of minutes. Let's come back to you, because there's something that we almost touched upon just now, talking about the media. One thing that youngsters are very definitely exposed to is the technology, not just of the stump cam, but the stump microphone. And increasingly you hear commentators apologising for language that's being used in the heat of the moment, as it always has been. As an under-8s and under-11s manager at Merstham, John, do you face many attitude issues, behavioural issues?
No, not at all. Not with my lot. And to be honest, we never have. We've had incidents on Friday evenings, which have been stopped, you know, and we do sit people out. We do try and instil some discipline. And of course, parents generally are there, so they are there, and they're very supportive, so that works well. But no, we don't have the same issues. We don't have the same parental pressure as the footballers get. There's no doubting that. And we wouldn't want it. That's not really what we're about, to be fair. And can I just say, you know, you're talking earlier about technical masterclasses, but that is very much something that, in my experience, people tend to get from television. And the input from the Hugheses of this world over the past few years have been fantastic. And that is what we miss. And we miss that at Colts, because on a Friday evening, it's very much about, you know, crowd control and enthusiasm and getting children involved. But to be able to take a group of children away, a small group, and give them technical skills training is what we really lack. And, you know, that's what I'd like more input with. If you look at the things like mini cricket, fantastic for the technical side. Can't really teach you about a game environment, but brilliant input for children.
John Dean, time flies when you're having fun. I've said that once already this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here with On the Front Foot, and we hope you'll come and see us again next year when the Colts season is in full swing. We'd enjoy that.
Thank you. I would love to. Thank you very much for this evening. It's been a pleasure.
It's been our absolute pleasure too. It's good to see you.
Susie, 103.4.
Welcome back to On the Front Foot. Tim Bowling's my co-pilot the other side. And joining us, the skipper of Burgess Hill Cricket Club in Sussex, Tom Trowbridge. Good evening and welcome to Susie 103.4.
Good evening.
It's very good to see you here, because you're the first real Sussex representative that we've had, Tom. So tell us a little bit about how the Sussex Championship is organised into divisions and where Burgess Hill are, and then we'll talk a bit about the club itself.
Well, this season actually there's been a slight change, because what they've done now is they've moved the second teams into the same sort of pyramid structure. So you have the Sussex Cricket League, which is the main sort of cricket structure in Sussex. You've got a couple of other feeder leagues as well, but the main one is the Sussex Cricket League. And you have the Premier Division at the top. And I believe they play half their season, they play 110 overs cricket, sort of 57 to the side batting first, and then they've obviously got to bowl a second side out, which puts the onus on declarations and captains to think a little bit more, I guess. And then the other half of the season is limited overs, so it's 50 overs a side, one day wides, fielding restrictions, bowling restrictions, and that filters down through the league system. So in our league, which is the third division of the county league, we play 100 overs, and then the other half of the season we play 45 overs a side.
And the limited overs is new for you this season?
It is, yeah. It's been introduced this season.
And how's the thing gone with these five second 11s being imported into Div 3?
Well, I think from our point of view, it's probably good news they've come in, because we've struggled this season, and I think we're the only first 11 in the whole of the Sussex League structure who's actually behind the second 11s. So I think we're second bottom at the moment, and below sort of four second 11s. But I think other than that, across the whole leagues, the second 11s have all been in the lower end of the table and the first 11s have been at the top end.
So perhaps the authorities were a little bit presumptuous in assuming that these second teams would hold their own, given that, sadly, as you know and I know, Burgess Hill haven't had the best of seasons. But apart from that, perhaps they were just a little bit presumptuous.
Yeah, I think so. I think they've probably come in a little bit too high. Although, you know, they're not... well out of their depth. I mean, certainly the second 11s we played this season have been good sides, but probably not as strong as the sides we had in our league last year.
Paradoxically, you've had one of your wins against one of the tip-top sides, local to our broadcast area.
Yeah, that's right, yes. We beat Crawley Eagles a couple of weeks ago. I think we're top of the table at the time. I think they might be second at the moment after we beat them, but yeah.
It's polarised at the top of Division 3, isn't it? There's four sides within about 10 points of one another.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think you've got Chichester, Crawley Eagles, Hayward Seath and Pagham are all up there.
Take us back then, Tom, if you will, if you can bear to the final day of last season and what happened.
Well, we started into the final game of last season, top of the league, and we were playing against the team in third place, knowing that if we won, we would be promoted as champions. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be. We bowled first. It was a little bit wet overnight, and the wicket was a little bit damp, and we bowled first and managed to bowl the opposition out for 110, I believe. We got to about 50 for one, I think, at tee, because we took an early... Rather than taking tee in between innings, because obviously the first innings was quite short, we went straight out, and then we took tee at 50 for one. And unfortunately, we couldn't get over the line after that, and all out for about 90. And unfortunately, we didn't even finish second, because the team finished who were behind us also won, and we ended up finishing third and narrowly missing out on promotion.
And tell us a little bit about the effect that had on your playing membership for this current season.
I think it had I'm not sure it had a huge impact necessarily, but it certainly had a bit of an impact. There's certainly a couple of players who really wanted to get up there and have a good push for it, and I think the memory is a bit too sore, so I've not played this year. I think we've also got to a stage where we've got a lot of people of similar age who sort of have other commitments, families, that sort of thing, and moved out of the area for jobs. And it's meant that this season we haven't had quite the same side we've had last year. I think the other problem we've had as well is we're all a similar age, and a lot of people are getting married or having stag do's. So actually I don't think I had the option to pick the same first 11 from week to week at any stage this season, which, as you know, makes it very difficult.
How many teams did Burgess Hill put out on a Saturday at the moment?
There's four teams out on a Saturday.
All league teams, are
they? All league teams, yeah. And which was absolutely fine last year, when we were turning people away each week and having to rotate the fours. Mm. But it's been a little bit more of a struggle this year.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Burgess Hill is a large catchment area, but to put out four teams regularly in the league is still pretty good going, I think, for sides these days. And we were talking about earlier on where clubs are having to sort of fold teams because they can't necessarily get the players out. But I think to put out four teams, and they're all good standards then, yeah?
Yeah, I think certainly the first two are good standards, and the third's actually played quite a high standard as well, slightly outside of, that's in the Mid-Sussex Stoner League, and now I think they're in Division 3 of that, might even be in Division 2,
yeah.
which is a good standard. Our fours is again, competitive cricket. It's not, I think from previous seasons they were playing in a conference, which is a bit more friendly, and you sort of got points for sort of team spirit and sportsmanship and that sort of thing, whereas now they're in a more competitive league.
Do you sort of use the fourth 11 and maybe the third 11 as a way of getting the Colts through to playing up higher up in the club?
Oh, definitely, yeah, that's definitely the idea of it. Definitely trying to bring, that's what it's all about. Certainly the fours and the threes as well, to be honest with you. It's just trying to get people playing adult cricket and slowly getting them sort of up, because it's quite a daunting thing as a 13, 14-year-old playing men's cricket for the first time. I mean, I can remember it.
Yeah.
And, it's just getting you confidence, because a lot of these youngsters are good enough, but it's just having the opportunity to do it and getting over that sort of mental hurdle almost of playing against adults.
Do you think... Would you say Burgess Hill is a club which, when a Colt is promoted perhaps up from the fourths to the thirds and ultimately to the seconds, that they're promoted in order to be used as a batsman or a bowler rather than being promoted just to fill a space, field at deep square leg and maybe bat at 11 and don't bowl?
Yeah, I think certainly you try and resist doing that as much as you can, because that doesn't help anyone at all, does it? I think, yeah, we've always said if we can try and get a youngster into the side, it's to do a job, either as batsman, bowler.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty we have a little bit, I think, is that sometimes we have youngsters who come up who are very good at batting and bowling, and maybe the team above have a few batsmen, but have too many bowlers almost. Mm. So it's also the balance of trying to bring them up at the right time so that they can actually come into the team and bat and bowl, which can sometimes be a bit tricky. So sometimes they won't do everything they want to, and then you have to try and manage them carefully and maybe bring them back down to the side below so they can actually use their other attributes. Otherwise, it's, you know, they lose it slightly.
Yeah. And my impression from being a fairly regular spectator with your first team, Tom, these days, is that you're also just a little bit short of top-end teams at the moment to come on into the senior sides.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there probably was a slight gap in our youth setups. We've got lots of 16s, 15s probably, and below, lots of very talented players in those brackets, but we probably haven't got quite so much between sort of 15 to sort of 20. That's probably our gap, and I think that's costing us, because now we've got to a stage where a lot of our players are about 30 are moving away from cricket or not playing so much, and we haven't quite got the depth which you probably would have got from people who are 15, 20 ready to step into the first team.
You had a season off to get married, but then they roped you back in as skipper this year, I notice. Tom, for the benefit of people, I mean, Redhill, Reigate, Hawley and then Crawley is our basic area. Tell us a little bit about a couple of the favourite Sussex grounds that you play on when you go south-east and south-west from Burgess Hill.
Obviously, Preston Nomads is probably the premier ground in Sussex, I'd say. It's always good fun playing there, and you always get a fantastic tea, which pleases a lot of people. I think when I was even scratching around for players this year a couple of times, it wasn't too difficult to persuade people to play at Preston Nomads. Obviously, Horsham's a great ground, and also we played at Eastbourne at the weekend, which has got good facilities and a decent wicket as well.
So you played on the Saffrons at the weekend?
We did, yes.
You came unstuck, sadly.
We certainly did, yeah.
So before we go on to think about Burgess Hill's prospects for the rest of this season, just tell us a little bit about the pros and cons of St John's at Burgess Hill and perhaps the difficulties of being quite as exposed to public use as a recreation ground and park as you are.
Yeah, I mean, it's right in the middle of Burgess Hill, so it's a bit of a thoroughfare. So even the day before, night before the game, obviously you'll have a lot of sort of young people going through the park and on their way home or whatever. So there's often a fair bit of debris on the park by the time you get there. Also, we also have to make sure everything's chained up and tied up and secured and locked down so it can't be taken. And unfortunately, we've had a spate of break-ins earlier in the year as well, which obviously, you know, costs us a bit of money as well, but it's just frustrating because you have to sort of bar more things up and makes it sort of less comfortable and sort of homely when you're in the facilities.
But public park or not, you've got your electronic scoreboard, you've got your sight screens, which obviously have to be rolled back in at the end of the game.
Yep.
In fact, there's a real all hands to the pumps, isn't there, at Burgess Hill when the game finishes, win, lose or draw?
Oh, certainly, yeah. No, you have to, all 11 players have to do their bit to get all the stuff away. It takes a sort of 20 minutes or so to put it all away. But we've got great facilities, actually. Obviously, electronic scoreboard, proper sight screens. When I first started playing, we had sort of fold-up sight screens, and if you've got a tall bowler, he goes straight over the top of it, whereas now we've got nice roll-on ones that are very high, and also a decent rope that can be seen. You don't need to put flags up at all, you can see it from the middle.
I've got to say, for somebody like me who plays at 3rd-11 standard, when you hear about sight screens, I think there's very few grounds I play at where there's ever a sight screen. You know, normally you're playing and the bowler's hand is coming out of dark trees or, you know, some wall or something, so yeah, it must be lovely to have proper sight screens.
Yeah, no, it's really good. I think I know what you mean. I remember when I realised I got used to sight screens, because I remember playing, actually I think it might have been at Crawley Eagles actually, but quite a long time ago, for about 10 years ago, when I think there wasn't sight screens. And I remember a bowler with a sort of bowling big induck, a slightly strange action, very front on, and I remember the first couple of balls I just didn't see. I just remember hitting me on the pads, and I remember thinking, I never thought I needed a sight screen before that. Like, I never even thought about
it. But also, it's funny how when you play at the lower levels like I do, and the amount of times where you do occasionally come across a ground where there is a sight screen, how many of the batsmen, I mean, I keep wicket, and it's amazing how many of the batsmen come in and they don't even realise there's a sight screen there, and it doesn't even get moved. And you think, well, do you want to move? No, just leave it where it is, don't worry. And then just they're not bothered.
Yeah.
You know, so, as you say, you rapidly get used to them when they're there regularly, but it's a different ball. It is literally a different ball game when that ball's coming out of the dark trees behind you. So,
have you played with a pink ball, Tom?
Yes, we have. Yes, I think for the first time this season we played with pink balls. We may have had them last season, but we've certainly in the it's only in the 2020 competition. But yeah, no, it's quite an interesting innovation. It doesn't seem to do anything more than the red ball, I wouldn't have said.
No, I did umpired some schools T20 or 6 or 7 years ago when these things were first in use. And this is at Hurstpier Point College on the second team ground on a gloomy Sunday morning, very gloomy Sunday morning, no sight screens. And these blooming pink things were going round corners. They were doing hoopla. It was extraordinary. But I think maybe they've ironed out one or two of the bits and pieces with that. Just before we move away from the ground, you have, of course, got the tremendous boon of that heavy roller.
Yes, yeah, no, that's fantastic. Obviously makes a huge difference, being able to roll that sort of a couple of times a week. And, I think our in Sussex, I'm sure it's probably the same in Surrey, you get marked on your pitches every season, and, I'm sure that they've gone up and up.
And in terms of marking, you, of course, are fortunate in your division that all your games have two panel umpires.
Yep, that's correct, yes, yeah.
And I know people moan, but the fact that you've got umpires at all is surely a huge bonus.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think sometimes... I think the best thing about it is that there's no doubt that they're impartial. So when a bad decision is made, which is always going to happen, I mean, the amount of mistakes that cricketers make every Saturday, you know, umpires make is probably a lot less than that. But you remember the mistakes that the umpire makes. But you can always console yourself in the fact that it's impartial, yeah. And then I think it means that you don't get a situation where tempers flares and all that.
Yeah,
sort of
I think
thing.
You're right. I mean, I think most people who play club cricket would say that they quite happily see an umpire being an umpire rather than one of the players having to do it. Mm-hmm. And 99.99% of them are just fine. And mm-hmm. if they make mistakes, well, then as you say, it's impartial, and mm-hmm. you accept that because mm-hmm. there's no malice involved, mm-hmm. and much better that than having to be roped into there's nothing worse for a player than when you have to be stand out an umpire as well. It's much better when you've got an umpire, and it makes such a big difference when you play against sides, even down at the level I play at, mm-hmm. when they bring an umpire along. I mean, we mm-hmm. used to have a regular umpire, unfortunately passed away, but it made such a difference. Mm-hmm. It's really, really good. But, yeah.
Tom, you've been playing first team cricket, what, 14, 15 years?
Yeah, that's probably about right, yeah.
You're what, 16 or so when you started?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
How many first-team hundreds have you got under your belt?
Well, I don't actually know the answer to that, but I suggest it, but it's not...
It's several.
It must be nearly the 10, fact, I think. Nearly 10, I think.
The fact that you don't know the number says that I can tell you how many hundreds I've got under my belt, and it's zero. So,
Tom, before we take a break for some a band with a cricket-themed name, what are the prospects for Burgess Hill First realistically in the rest of this season? And if the worst should happen, presumably there's not that much difference in standard at the moment between Div 3 and Div 4 anyway.
It's difficult to tell, actually, between the standard in Div 3 and Div 4. But, yeah, our prospects, our goal is to try and stay up. We're second bottom at the moment, but we're not cut adrift. We've got, certainly, it's in our hands. We've got a lot of the teams around us to play. So I'm still confident we can get out of it. But if the worst was to happen, then, yeah, there's quite a few lovely grounds, actually, in the division below us. Stirlings is another ground, as I mentioned, which is a lovely place to play cricket. I think Sussex Seconds have played there before, and they play a bit of Colts cricket there as well. So, yeah, I don't think it'll be as competitive, but... it would be competitive enough, I'm sure.
But the aim is very much to stay up.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And, of course, if you do end up in the same division as Stenning again, that's a little bit of a riding two horses job for you, because you played a little bit at Stenning, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. When I was, I think, between the ages of about 18 and 22 or something like that, I used to play for Stenning when they were in the Premier Division and in Division 2.
And isn't it strange how now Burgess Hill are in the third division and Stenning in the division below? It's how it goes.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Tom, do you manage to keep up with the first-class game?
Yeah, I do a little bit. I don't get to see very much of it at all. It's just it's not on times. If you're working all week and then you're playing on a all day on a Saturday, you don't really get the chance to watch too much of it. Even if it's on a Sunday, I'm not sure my wife would give me permission to do that.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
I certainly always keep an eye on the scores, and I'll often actually, even at work, have probably shouldn't say this live on air, but have Crick Info open where you can just see the score running across the bottom of your screen. Whenever Sussex are playing, I tend to have that on.
I think there's no harm at all in having a window open on. I think that's a positive incentive, quite honestly. Any employer who wanted to kick up about that should, well, turn the other cheek, maybe. There's quite a strong sense of county in Sussex, isn't there? And quite a strong allegiance to Hove.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah.
Do you think that there are perhaps too many young cricketers in Sussex vying for too few places on the county's books?
I don't think so, if I'm honest. I think... if you look at other counties, so sort of Yorkshire, for example, the size of their catchment area and population, I think I'm sure there's lots more players vying for that spot. I think it's probably about right in Sussex, if I'm honest. And I think that's probably fairly reflected in where they are in the second division. I think if they had more youngsters coming through, they'd be a lot stronger. So,
where do you stand in the red-hot debate about T20 versus one-day versus traditional four-day and five-day test match cricket?
If I'm honest, I think that I quite enjoy T20, I quite enjoy watching that, and I enjoy test match cricket as well. I wouldn't be too disappointed if it was just test match cricket and T20. I think that sort of then suits both sides. I find one-day cricket's got more exciting in the last two or three years, especially the sort of brand of cricket in England are playing, when it's more like a T20 for longer. And they've done well to sort of get rid of that phase where you had sort of 20 overs in the middle of a 50 over game where the spinners would just be milked 4 or 5 and over. Let's try not to lose more than 1 or 2 wickets, and everyone sort of knew what was going on. I think they've sort of got that out of there, but still I think test match and T20 are, I think, probably the ones for me.
I suppose the great thing about test match cricket, said he from recent experience, is that you can go and have a day out and dine out and have a glass or two, and the cricket's a nice sort of contented background to all that.
Yeah, definitely. It's a sort of social occasion.
And the 50-over stuff remains quite a long day, doesn't it, really, by the time you've been there and watched it and got home again?
I have to say, I quite like the 50-over game. I like the fact in 50-over cricket that the game, it does... you're right, there used to be that sort of period in the middle which could become a bit dull, but I do like the fact that in a 50-over game there's that ebb and flow of the match, and the fact that, you know, obviously in T20 cricket, one player can win a game. You know, you get a good batsman in, get a big score, or a good bowler, one player can just completely change the game. In one-day cricket, it's not quite as easy to do that, and the team is more involved. I think perhaps from my point of view, I don't want one-day cricket to disappear because I'm desperate for England to still win the World Cup. And I think until you know, like, we've won the T20 World Cup, but we've never won what I would consider to be the real World Cup. And unfortunately, I don't know, it doesn't look like we're ever going to win it anytime soon, but who knows. But I still think there's a place for 50-over cricket in the whole game going forward.
Yeah, it's a crowded season, though, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, you've got the women off the back of this World Cup triumph, and it's about a fortnight until their 20-over tournament begins. But let's hope that'll be marketed. Let's not go back to women's cricket after that phenomenal success. Tom, we ask everybody who comes, how do you see the South African series panning out now after this extraordinary turnaround at Trent Bridge, where traditionally England have been strong?
Well, I think my answer would have been completely different if you'd asked me... after Lords, but I really don't know, if I'm honest. I think the oval's often quite a flat wicket, typically, and I feel like that doesn't suit England terribly. I think with their bowling attack, they need a little bit in the wicket, a little bit of lateral movement, and historically our spinners haven't been fantastic, but actually, to be honest with you, after the first game, if they do produce a bit of a bunce and the turns, that might be their best chance, I think, actually.
Mr. Amler has form at the Oval. Was it 640-odd for two when that Graham Smith was still captain? Yeah. I sat here a couple of weeks back and said 2-1 to England. I think that is England. They blow hot, blow cold. But it's 6 out of 8 they've lost off the bounce, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the first test against South Africa, everybody thought, you know, new era. Joe Root had waited 6 months to be captain and whatever. And obviously, it turned out to be a little bit, perhaps, of a false dawn. I think South Africa were missing a couple of key players in that test. We'll see going forward. I'm quite surprised that England aren't looking more at the spin department. I know they've kept Dawson in the squad, and I know Batty was a sort of stopgap during the winter, but I'm surprised his name wasn't even mentioned when they were discussing the squad for this particular test. I would have thought he would have been he could have done another stopgap job, which perhaps Dawson isn't necessarily up to it quite yet.
They don't do horses for courses anymore, though, do they? No. They pick them and they stick with them.
Yeah.
And,
which is no bad thing, to be fair, is it? Let's be honest.
And I suppose central contracts and England almost being a 19th county given a certain sort of bias to that. Let's just think for a second, if we may, go sort of round the back door to cricket abroad. The Ashes this winter can't be a foregone conclusion, can they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the problem is the Australians are still going through this pay dispute, so they've got lots of problems over there with that. I think when it comes to the Ashes, it's just a different level, isn't it? It's the pinnacle. It's still the pinnacle of any player's career. I think players raise their game for that particular series. I honestly wouldn't be able to make a prediction. I don't know. What do you think? I don't know, Tom.
I think it's very difficult to look past Australia for the Ashes, to be honest with you. I think the bowling attack we have, I feel like, may struggle in Australia, just because I think you need a bit of X factor in Australia. You need a bit of, I think, either someone particularly quick or a decent spinner. And I think, to be honest, we probably haven't got either of those things. Our seamers are very good. Anderson and Broad are fantastic, of course. But I think when it's flat and it's not doing a lot, I don't think they've got the extra pace to really trouble someone. And if it's not doing a lot, then we can go for plenty. Whereas I think Australia do have a bit of X factor in the attack. And on flat wickets, I think they've got the bowlers with Pattinson, Stark, Cummins and Hazelwood, who looks a good bowler, actually, who probably can go through a side.
I think also the problem we've got is that we're playing South Africa now. We've then got the West Indies, who unfortunately are not the team that they were in the past, and that is our preparation for the Ashes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be very difficult to try and gauge certainly from the West Indies series, how well we're going to do against the Australians. We might get some idea in this final test against South Africa, but in terms of trying to work out how we're going to play against the Aussies, this is the test where we're going to have to try and decide, because it's not, the West Indies shouldn't pose much of a threat. If we struggle against the West Indies, we've had it against mm-hmm. the Aussies, but we shouldn't. We should go through the West Indies pretty quickly, and then who knows?
You mentioned Cummins and Stark in particular. I think in their own backyard, and if they're fit and firing, Australia have got pace. And I go back to the way in which Chris Morris bowled it a bit quick and discomfited our best two players at Trent Bridge. So I think we might see a bit more of that down under this winter. Let's pause and think about this pay dispute. Surely with cricketing mercenaries a la Chris Gayle, who was probably the first and most successful, playing in T20 leagues around the world, and this new South African league taking place now, is it not the case that players with any board will be able to hold their boards to ransom in future?
Yeah, I think possibly. I mean, it's interesting, though, that in this instance, it's the players clubbing together to make sure that those that aren't at the top level get the same pay deal that the top test players get. I mean, Steve Smith has said that they're adamant that everybody should get the same deal. And I think that's quite encouraging in a way, that the players are taking that attitude, rather than just being the centrally contracted players at the top saying, no, we're having the lion's share of the money and everybody else can just get on with it. I think it's actually quite an encouraging thing that the players have decided to take this this line. But whether it'll have an effect on the actual players playing during the Ashes, whether it's at the back of their mind, it's only, you know what it's like in, we know what it's like in professional sport. Professionals seem to be, it doesn't take much to turn them. And if they're worrying about pay disputes, that may well be to our advantage.
Yeah, I suppose it's not quite the same as it was 40 years ago, and it is 40 years since dear old Bill Frindle rang me up one night, said, have you heard about the cricket circus? I said, what are you on about, Bill? And that was when Packer started, 40 years ago. And, of course, before that, England cricketers and international cricketers around the world were paid peanuts.
Well, was it true that Dennis Lilly said that one of the reasons he signed for Packer was that he was playing for Australia, and he worked out that the guy that was moving the site, we're talking about site screen, that the guy that was moving the sight screen was getting paid more than he was as a test player for Australia, and that's why he ended up signing up for Packer.
Dennis may have been prone to exaggeration in word and deed, like when he kicked Javed Miandad, the poison dwarf, but that's all a very long time ago. Tom, what about Afghanistan and Ireland being admitted to the test fold?
I think it's a positive thing, but I think it'd be difficult to get that excited about England playing against Ireland or Afghanistan, having a series there. I think I'm not sure what the arrangement's going to be. Is it going to be a tiered process? Are they going to be having two separate divisions to an extent? Or
I confess I haven't read up on the details yet. It's just something I've got on the pad in front of me. So I think we'll wait and see. The jury's probably out on that one. It's difficult, isn't it, to assess? I mean, I can remember in the days of Billy Birmingham, the Australian 12th man who did those satirical tapes, getting on for 30 years ago now, taking the mickey out of the poor little Sri Lankans at that stage. stage and pretending that the score in a 50-over game was 500 for two. But it wasn't really very long after that with Mahela and Kumar Sangakkara and a few of them, and the boot was firmly on the other foot. Mm. On the other hand, Zimbabwe, perhaps not of their own making, have struggled, haven't they?
Well, to be fair to Zimbabwe, they've come back. They've just beaten Sri Lanka in a series. Talking about Sri Lanka, and they've got Heath Streak in charge now over there. They've managed to try and cobble together a team again after the big walkout they had sort of 15 years ago. So Zimbabwe are coming back now as a side. We talked about Ireland just now. The problem that Ireland are going to have now that they've got Test Nation status is that their players playing in county cricket will not be able to play as... they'll have to become overseas players, and they can't just play as domestic players. Now, this could mean that many of those Irish players have to decide whether they want to play for Ireland or whether they want to continue to play in more lucrative cricket, let's call it, in T20 cricket, and not play for Ireland. So, actually, by getting Test match status... Ireland could find they struggle to actually get those players to carry on playing for them because of the money.
It'll be fascinating to see how that all unfolds, won't it? Shall we talk box office for a minute, gentlemen? Because I know, Tim, you wanted to go back to good old KP.
Yes, well, I'm sure many of the listeners will have seen the performance he had at the Oval the other night, four sixes in a row, and then... All right, he did his usual, got to the score he felt he needed to get, and then got out, and then all of a sudden he's tweaked an injury and he can't field. But it was an impressive performance, and I think the most notable comment came from him after the match, where he suggested, perhaps pushed by the journalist, but he suggested he may well play for South Africa in 2019. And I know his name obviously wasn't mentioned in the England squad this time, but is there still a place for him in the England setup? If the South Africans think he's good enough, should we be thinking about KP back in the England team?
Did you see any of the Surrey Middlesex T20 on Friday night, Tom?
I didn't, I'm afraid, no.
Well, there was an absolutely fascinating interview conducted ever so well by Andrew Flintoff, strolling across the outfield with KP, during which Mr. Peterson opined that at the moment he could bat in any one of the top four places in England's batting order, left-handed with no pads, and do a better job. And he certainly didn't rule out playing for South Africa in that 2019 World Cup. But of course it went on Friday night, because having been past fit and gone through the fitness tests, he lasted one ball, during which he ran out Aaron Finch, who was going like a train at the other end, and then went in the fetlock and had to have a runner. It was quite... There's never anything dull when...
How many times, though, do you see Kevin Peterson coming out to bat, and the first ball he pushes it straight to cover point and calls a run? Yeah. And most of the time they get away with it, but how often does he run people out when he's on zero? He does it so often. It's such a selfish thing to do, you know, but that's Peterson.
Have you got a take on KP, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great shame that he doesn't play for England anymore, actually. I think because of his ability, sort of depriving everyone of seeing how good he is and the things he could achieve. But I think with Kevin Peterson, I think you're right, it is a selfish thing, that sort of attitude. And he's not really fitted in wherever he's played. I think there's stories of when he was at Nottinghamshire, his bag being thrown off the top of the balcony.
Thrown off the balcony, that's right.
And he seems to have done that wherever he's been. So it can't always be everyone else, I don't think.
No,
and
no. I mean, I think, I guess it could be argued that to be as good as he is, you have to be single-minded, and that's the reason he's got to the top, perhaps. But yeah, you're right. I mean, when it happens at successive counties and other sides that he plays for, when people say, well, he's a pain... Mm-hmm. It can't always be other people who've got the problem, I think, but we'll see.
Single-minded, I mean, it wasn't a number of counties, but Geoffrey who?
Yes, yes, well, that's right, exactly. But that's the same thing, isn't it? That single-minded, you know, just want to bat and just want to be top of the game. You do need that to get to the top of any professional sport, but it's how you sort of control it and how much it just takes over the whole, whether you want to play in a team or whether you want to play for yourself.
No, I think England could do with Geoffrey Boycott at number three at the moment, and he's 76 years old, you know.
I'm sure he'd play if he was called up.
We have lost a little bit of the ability to graft at test level, haven't we?
Well, let's be honest, that's why they've got Keaton Jennings. They're sticking with Keaton Jennings, and they did try Gary Balance again. He's been the number one batsman in the county game. they're sticking with Keaton Jennings. Tom, do you think they should stick with Keaton Jennings, or do you think they should get rid of him now and try and bring someone else in?
I think they've got a little choice, to be honest with you. They're not awash with options in the county circuit. I know Mark Stoneman's being talked about quite a lot as another opener, but if you look at sort of who are the openers who are scoring loads of runs, or the number threes who are scoring loads of runs, and that's the issue, really. I think that's why Balance came in and batted at three, where he's not batting at three for real. He's clearly not a number three.
Exactly, and that's the problem, isn't it? They bring a batsman in, he scores tons of runs in county cricket at a particular position. Mm-hmm. He's then picked for England, pushed to number three, doesn't score runs. All right, he's been injured, but he would have been dropped. And he'd be lucky if he gets back in the side.
Yeah, I think he may have been able to do a job at five or six for England. But his technique isn't suitable for batting at number three at Test Match cricket. I think even at county cricket, if he was batting at three, he probably wouldn't have scored the runs he scored.
Exactly.
It's a little bit unfair on him in a way.
He bats very deep in his crease. Mm-hmm. And I think the bowlers, especially the South African bowlers, pick that out very, very quickly. And they could push balls down, swing a little bit late, and he just couldn't cope with it.
Gentlemen, we're almost out of time for the third time this evening. I'll say time flies. Tom, who have you got this coming weekend?
This Saturday we have Preston Nomads at home.
Preston Nomads. Well,
their second team, that is.
Not Preston Nomads away, so pictorial it won't be quite. So how are your selection situations this weekend?
A few issues, to be honest with you, because I'm at a wedding, and two or three other players are at a wedding as well, and a couple of people are on a holiday, so... Yeah, a bit of a juggle at the moment.
Well, we wish Burgess Hill all good fortune this weekend anyway. Tom Trowbridge, skipper of Burgess Hill, it's been a delight to have you with us here at Susie 103.4 this evening. Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, David.
Tom, you'll come and see us again?
Certainly will, do you?
Look forward to it. You've been listening to On the Front Foot, Susie Radio's cricket chat show. Extending into Sussex this very evening, my thanks to our guests, Tom Trowbridge from Burgess Hill, John Dean, under-8s Colts manager at Merstham, just up the road, and our good friend John Colcutt from Newdigate Cricket Club. That League Cup semi-final at Newdigate on the 6th of August, that's a Sunday, all welcome. We'll be back, not next month, because this has been the August edition. We'll be back early in September. We'll see you then, and until the next time, from me and from us, good evening.